Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
I think his work is blacker in some respects than people have realized. Mm. He has the same sort of humor as Samuel Beckett. He is an Irish playwright, remember. But it's also full of levity. He is floating in a balloon above a dark valley, in a way. And there's that mixture of lightness and darkness, which is extraordinary.
The Life of George Bernard Shaw, this week on Soundings. My guest is Michael Holroyd. The second volume in Michael Holroyd's three-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw was published last fall. Volume 3 is scheduled for publication in 1991. Michael Holroyd's biography of Shaw is published by Random House. Michael Holroyd, welcome to the National Humanities Center and to Soundings.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Let me begin with something idiosyncratic. I understand that he didn't like his first name. Is that true?
He didn't. Look at any work by Shaw, and you will find that he is not George Bernard Shaw, he is just Bernard Shaw. And I think there was a particular reason for that. He grew up in Ireland in a ménage à trois. His father was called George, but the other man in the household was also called George. And when he was an adolescent, he wondered if perhaps he was illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And George became the symbol of uncertainty, of unsureness, if you like. and so he dropped it. Don't George me, he would tell people. And he didn't George himself either. So he is Bernard Shaw and never George.
He is a man of, what, strong opinions, I take it. Let me put a series of words on the table here, Michael Holroyd, and you talk to me in terms of what GBS Bernard Shaw was like, how he might have reacted. Alcohol?
Yes, he didn't drink. His father was an alcoholic. What Shaw, in fact, I think, did was to watch his father, think that he had inherited a tendency to an addiction, and turn it from alcohol to work. He was a workaholic, but he didn't drink.
What about vegetarianism?
Yes, one of the reasons he took to vegetarianism when he came to London in the 1870s, when he was about 20, was that there were a lot of vegetarian restaurants springing up which were incredibly cheap. You could eat for a few pence, and he had no money. Uh-huh. And that was one reason. There was another reason, that he was a very fastidious man. And the idea of being, as it were, a coffin to dead animals,
oh,
is the way
goodness.
He thought of it, precisely.
Uh-huh.
So he was really a very strong advocate in favor of vegetarianism. He thought that eating lots of meat weighed you down. Uh-huh. He wanted to be light on his feet.
Uh-huh. I suppose that the animal rights people today would look upon him as some sort of a prophet.
Yes, very much so. He was in many respects ahead of his time, and that is just one of them.
Uh-huh. What did he think about marriage?
He thought that marriage should be based perhaps more on intimate friendship than sexual attraction.
Yeah, I understand that he disparaged romantic love. Yes and no?
Well, yes and no. He thought that the sex instinct and therefore romantic love was vitally important to our future. Quite obviously it was. But there was so much romantic propaganda in the atmosphere that he wanted to stamp on it, he said, with thick boots.
Mm-hmm.
Be a counter-propagandist, really. Mm-hmm. And as for marriage, if it was based on sexual attraction only, then it grew into an imprisonment later on called wedlock.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought people were made very unhappy by that.
Mm-hmm. Well, today it's fashionable in the academy and in our popular culture to talk about issues of sex and gender, homosexuality and various relationships among and between the sexes. Was Shaw, what, ahead of his times in that regard?
Well, I think he was very much in his later plays, which are not so well known. A play, for example, called The Simpleton of the Unexpected Isles has got the sexes merged very much, and you are suddenly seeing something not only of this time, but perhaps even of the future. Mm-hmm. So in his late life, which was rather like Shakespeare's late period, like The Tempest, mm-hmm. plays like that, surrounded by seas and islands and dreams and prophecies, he is merging the sexes and gender in, mm-hmm. in a most interesting way, not well known for him.
It sounds like what the Platonic conception, we are all essentially one sex and we're looking for the other half and all of that.
He would be sympathetic to that view uh-huh. very much. Yeah.
Was George Bernard Shaw a scholar in any sense, Michael Holroyd, insofar as he would do what we call research in figuring out his themes and ideas?
Well, he never went to university, but he used the reading room of the British Museum, as it was then called, rather than the British Library, as it's now called, in London, as his university. Uh-huh. And he read and read and read the lists of books that he read. He read in whole encyclopedias.
Did you have to go back and read these things in order
not
to...
Not every single one, but I looked at a number, and I mean, there were some seminal works. Das Kapital, uh-huh. for example, which he read in French, oddly enough, with the aid of a dictionary. Goodness. So he was a self-taught, irregular scholar, uh-huh. not easily to be categorized.
Well, given that as a background, how did he arrive at his ideas about money and politics and society, socialism, his involvement with the Fabians? Talk to me for a few minutes about that.
Well, of course, it was partly from reading. He thought that Das Kapital took the lid off capitalism. And he transferred any personal grievances he'd had from a very unhappy childhood into criticism of the social organizations. He thought that perhaps his parents' unhappiness had been the product of the marrying for love mm-hmm. of money, and that the money motive had been stressed too much. And in one of his early plays, for example, Mrs. Warren's Profession, he uses prostitution as a symbol of capitalism, uh-huh. what people will do for money if you put them in that position. Mm-hmm. He wanted to really convert unequal private property into common wealth, to level up, not down. That's what his ideal was. That is what his politics were all about.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the relationship between George Bernard Shaw's mother and father. Did he know about Freud? Did he know Freud?
He never met him personally, but he knew of his work and uh-huh. picked up something of Freud. He called him an author utterly without delicacy. The great effect of Freud, he thought, was to liberate the language, mm-hmm. to enable us to utter things that had been unspeakable before, in the same way that some other writers, D.H. Lawrence, for example, did the same thing. And he thought that was a great liberation. Only it came a little bit too late in the day to change mm-hmm. his own vocabulary a great deal.
Let's continue with this list of terms here in our conversation about George Bernard Shaw, Michael Holroyd. What about music? I understand that Wagner was a great influence on his life.
Wagner and Mozart were two gods. He was musical. The only happy sound in his house when growing up in Ireland was the sound of music. His mother had a mezzo-soprano voice of great purity, it was said, and the other George in the household, George van der Lely, was a conductor, a musical wizard, a Svengali figure. And so the coming together of voices, Catholic and Protestant voices, was a symbol of harmony and happiness. He taught himself, nobody bothered to teach him, to play the piano. He learnt the scores of operas, and when he came to London, he had equipped himself to be an extraordinarily good and witty critic of music, particularly of opera. And one of the great releases of opera is that you could be emotional in opera mm-hmm. without making a fool of yourself. Yeah. Indeed, that was a great release for him.
How did Wagnerian music and Mozart, the themes that he was interested in musically, how did that influence him politically? Don't you talk about a relationship there?
Well, I think he got very much both from, well, Ibsen really, and Wagner, the notion that there are in politics three types of people. There is the mass of people, who you could call the Philistines, if you like, and that's about 90% of people. Then there are the idealists, who are intellectuals, clever people, who are in the pay of the Philistines to give the good arguments for holding to the status quo, for doing nothing, for turning back, for being conservative. And they're clever people, they're like very clever barristers. And then there's the one person who he called the realist, 1 in 100.
Is this the Superman?
In a way, it became that in his terminology, yes. Uh-huh. The man who sees the reality of the future, and that we have to invest in the future, and that although it seems so frightening to change, it is in fact disastrous not to do so. That uh-huh. is the paradox. And he therefore played with those words, because normally, what normally people would call an idealist, he called a realist.
Uh-huh.
And what normally people would call a realist, saying, you know, I understand what's going on now, I'm practical, he called that idealizing the present.
Now, I just used the word Superman here, paraphrasing, talking about George Bernard Shaw. What if I'd said superwoman or superwoman? How did Shaw feel about feminism and the equality between the sexes, all of that?
Well, he was a great believer on the equality of the sexes. I mean, he wrote very good parts for women in the theatre and insisted on women being on the committees of anything he was serving on, because he thought that if half the population was, as it were, not represented, you got a very lopsided opinion. He also believed that, of course, women should have the vote, but he believed that in something called the coupled vote. He thought that in a proper democracy, you shouldn't just vote for a single person in a constituency. You should have to vote for two people, a man and a woman. Therefore, you get the same number of women as men in public office, and that would do us all a great deal of good.
Talk about being ahead of
your
time.
Well, indeed, indeed. Yeah.
What about organized religion or belief or spirituality, the transcendental? How did Shaw feel about those things?
Well, he was again unorthodox. He didn't believe in Old Testament religions. He thought that they'd played their part, but religion, like everything else, must evolve. He was a believer in what he called the life force, in the evolutionary appetite, in the mystery of energy, of divine energy, rather like Blake.
Elan vital,
like Bergson. Yeah. It's very, very similar. And that God didn't exist in the past and create the world in 7 days. He was in the process of creating himself. We were his instruments. And we better get a move on and do it, because mm-hmm. it was a race against the environment.
What did he say about a name like Darwin, for or against?
Well, he was for Darwin insofar as Darwin had exploded old beliefs, and he was against Darwin insofar as it seemed to make everything a matter of pure luck.
Hmm.
And whereas he believed there might be more in Lamarck. Well,
by that you mean what? Some sort of design behind
will,
the design?
Some will, right. Yes, indeed. I mean, was it that the giraffe stayed alive because it could reach the higher leaves of a tree? Or did the giraffe, through willpower, over many centuries, grow that long neck? Uh-huh. That was the point.
How did Shaw feel about science and technology? Here he lives from the middle of the 19th to precisely, well, not precisely, yeah, I guess it was 1950, isn't that when he died? The middle of the 20th century.
Yes, absolutely. Extraordinary man. Right?
And he was able to see, what, the rise of technology.
Yes.
Would he have looked on it as the promise of technology or the curse?
Well, there were two things. He didn't like the the priesthood of scientists. He thought that religion, that sort of blind obedience to seers and prophets, had moved from old-fashioned religion into the sciences, and he poo-pooed that, especially the doctors and so on, because the latest theories are always being overturned, and one mustn't make gods of doctors.
Was this jealousy because he was not educated formally himself? What?
Yes, there is an element of that in it. There's an element of authority. Who has the real authority? The narrow expert or the Renaissance man? And he was in favor of interdisciplinarian techniques, really, of learning. For example, the scientists, he always felt, should be aesthetic. And indeed, someone like Einstein, of course, was aesthetic. And he knew Einstein and, in fact, brings him into his late work. And they had rather high opinion of one another. But he was interested very much in the latest technology. He was like a schoolboy with all the latest gadgets, you know, the wireless. He wasn't always good at, you know, driving a motor car, but he knew all about it and wrote learned articles on it.
Michael Holroyd, we're talking about your, the second volume here has just come out in your three-volume work on the life of George Bernard Shaw. A couple of more terms here that I want to put on the table, and then we'll talk about the biographical enterprise and some of the literary interests that that Shaw has in his life. What about censorship? What do you think about that?
He campaigned all his life against censorship. It is interesting that many of the battles that he eventually won are now being refought in Britain.
In what way?
Well, they did away, partly due to his campaign, with somebody called the Lord Chamberlain, who used to oversee all plays. But now we've got a new person called Lord Rees-Mogg, who is to oversee all television programmes in almost precisely the same way. So the old battles will have to be fought. He thought that life was trial and error. Of course you made error, but if you were too safe, that was even more dangerous.
What about some of Shaw's literary heroes, heroines, mentors, models, enemies? Talk to me for a moment about those types.
Well, in the theatre, a great hero was Ibsen, I think, who he never met. But amongst people he did know was H.G. Wells, whom he thought a great man and a great writer, and someone who had the public imagination, really, and whose science fiction work was prophetic. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, was another man who, he had a great battle. Would Chesterton become a Catholic or would he not? Well, he did. And they did many public debates on religion up and down the country, which were amazingly popular. People crowded in. What was so wonderful about those debates is that each attacked the other person's opinion really fiercely, but left the other with self-respect, never hurt the other personally. It is perhaps a great lesson to us today, some of those debates.
So we didn't have a lot of ad hominem stuff. We had, an exchange of ideas.
Yes, very much so.
What about the Bloomsbury groups? Here we have these two circles of literati in England. What was Shaw's connection there?
Well, he tried to put them on stage to some extent in his play Heartbreak House, after having met Virginia and Leonard Woolf in 1916 with the Webbs. What is interesting about these two groups, the Fabian Society, I would say, to which Shaw belonged, and the Bloomsbury Group, to which Strachey and Virginia Woolf belonged, is that they both wanted to escape from Victorian values, but they had different priorities. The Bloomsburys really thought that the better life consisted of personal relationships and aesthetic sensibility, and that they wanted to celebrate the values of civilized private life over the vulgarities of public life, whereas Shaw thought that top priority must be given to economic reform and also to breaking down the class system, so that people could be friends, lovers, could marry. It didn't matter what class or money. So he believed in economic reform, absolutely top of the tree, really.
Well, those are noble goals, Michael Holroyd. What was he like personally? In his own personal life and bearing, did he, did he favor these things? Did he endorse them?
Well, I mean, he didn't give away all his money, but then he believed that what he believed in really had to be brought about collectively, not individually. He was secretly a most generous man. His private correspondence is full of giving away £5, £10, £100, annuities to people. But he wanted this to remain secret. When there were annuities, one of the sort of caveats was that no one should be told about this, or else they would stop. At the same time, he represented himself in public as a skinflint, absolutely tightwad. And that sounds mad. Most people pretend to be more generous than they are. But in fact, it was very sensible when you think about it, because it was known that he'd won the Nobel Prize, that he was a successful writer, must have money. And so everybody would be writing to him to get what they could, and what in sometimes in dire need. And that really was not the job of an individual, to ease the symptoms of capitalism by charity. It should be done by central government funds.
Do you feel that you know this man, Michael Holroyd? Let's talk about the biographical enterprise for a moment. I'm thinking specifically of the following question. Is the work the life, or how do you figure out the representation of a terribly complex character such as Bernard Shaw?
Well, of course, I do a lot of reading. I come into contact with him, as it were, by actually holding the very piece of paper that he held in by letter or diary, whatever it may be.
Something electric there, huh?
One very much hopes that something happens, yeah. That's where the magic lies. Of course, I read all published things. And then I walk around and I think and I feel. I think there's no thought without some feeling. I believe, biographically, that the lives of writers lie between the lines of the text of the work. And that if you can study the life, you can fruitfully disturb and enrich that text, to some extent. That is my literary biographical belief.
Does that make of you a psychobiographer? Are you, as it were, speaking for the man or speaking about the man?
I speak about. I don't use any psychological jargon at all. And I don't, so far as I'm aware, anyway, consciously, have preconceived views. I don't have a psychoanalytical ideology of any sort. But something grows up between the subject and the biographer, because what in a way a biographer or a literary biographer is doing anyway is to say to his or her subject, will you please write one more work posthumously in collaboration.
with him.
Exactly.
Given that as a backdrop, Michael Holroyd, let's talk for a moment about some of Shaw's dramatic writings, his plays.
Well, I think that he is an author, a playwright with a future. I think that many of the themes that he had, such as disarmament, unemployment, medical ethics, the relationship of Ireland and England, the peaceful invasion of Britain by America, are very much current. If you look at Heartbreak House, what is Captain Shotover brooding on if it isn't a version of President Reagan's Star Wars? If you look at a late play, The Millionaires, at this triumphant and tragic heroine, if that isn't Mrs. Thatcher, I don't know who is. So there are actual echoes of today that you pick up again and again. What he did was to change the repertoire of the theatre from sentimental Victorian melodrama and pantomime into the theatre of ideas. And he wanted it, of course, to change the mind of his audience and for that to have some effect in the country, a peaceful reform and revolution. Some of his plays should be cut by 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour. Now, some people will think that a heresy. I know I am right. We're much quicker on things now. He hasn't got to repeat something. We know what's meant. His plays completely come out of copyright at the end of this century. I think we'll see an extraordinarily flowering of his work.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Michael Holroyd, again, you are the author of a 3-volume series of biographical works here on George Bernard Shaw. You know this man. That's very clear. Do you like him?
The answer to that question is yes. But my book is not based on like. I am not saying to my readers, here's a swell guy, here's a nice chap, here's a good buddy. That's not what it is. I am paying the reader, or attempting to pay the reader, a compliment by saying, here is something that will stimulate you, that may make you laugh your way into a different opinion, that may unsettle you, provoke you, stimulate you. It won't always be easy. You will have some laughs. You will, I hope, have some new information and learn something. And you will perhaps find out what yesterday was like and how one arrived here.
Quick footnote to our conversation, Michael Holroyd. What has been the greatest difficulty or challenge, and what has been the most rewarding element of your work about George Bernard Shaw?
The most difficult thing to write about was some of the politics. Some of the stuff like tariff reform took me months to learn, and I didn't always use everything I learned, because you have to learn more and then use just a little bit to understand what you're leaving out is as important as what, in the process of selection. What I've enjoyed particularly is Shaw's private personal life. I wished him to be seen not as a dry stick, but as a man of passion. And I like to show him at home, the domestic privacies, and as a rather endearing man.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Michael Holroyd. Michael Holroyd is the author of a 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw, published by Random House. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 487. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of discussions on literary and historical themes apropos of Black History Month 1990. My guests will include scholars from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the University of Virginia, the University of Florida, and Duke University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor 2 enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week is the anniversary of the Greensboro sit-in. In early February 1960, 4 black students from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College were refused service at a Woolworth lunch counter, and a wave of protests swept the nation. This week also marks the anniversary of Robinson Crusoe Day, in recognition of the rescue in 1709 of Alexander Selkirk. Selkirk's adventures on Juan Fernandez Island inspired Daniel Defoe's novel. Happy birthday this week to James Joyce, the Irish novelist, to the first female physician, Elizabeth Blackwell, to the American illustrator, Norman Rockwell, to the novelist, Zane Grey, and to the baseball player and executive, Jackie Robinson. James Joyce was born in early February 1882, Elizabeth Blackwell in 1821, Norman Rockwell in 1894, Zane Grey in late January 1875, and Jackie Robinson in 1919. Finally, 2 American presidents have birthdays this week, William McKinley, who died at the hands of an assassin, and Franklin D. Roosevelt, the only chief executive to serve 4 terms. They were born in late January 1843 and 1882. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Life of George Bernard Shaw, this week on Soundings. Shaw's life spanned nearly 100 years, from 1856 to 1950. From just before Darwin's Origin of Species to the dawn of the atomic age. His biographer, Michael Holroyd, discusses Shaw's life and extraordinary literary output. George Bernard Shaw, this week on Soundings.